WGXC is a listener-supported community radio station, and it is also a new platform for presenting innovative experimental works on the air. Tune in, WGXC 90.7 FM, Agra, Hudson, Catskill, and points beyond. Listen to special programs of performance, words, sounds, and other rare and delicious items. Transmitting the arts all day every Saturday, and weekdays after midnight. Here is there. Radio lives on in our minds and hearts.
You are listening to Human Machine, a program that airs each Saturday on WGXC 90.7 FM. Research in various scientific fields examine a speculative next stage in human evolution. Many predict an imminent human transformation based on increasing computer processing speed and manufacture, which will merge technological and human architectures. In this series, we will present projects and research about the horizons of the human machine. The program alternates weekly between Jeremy Kelly's curation of machine systems influence composers and Maximilian Goldfarb's assembly of materials that depict the convergence of humans and technology. Episodes will be thematically arranged to cover topics such as autonomous vehicles, medicine, sexual relations, space and habitation, nanotechnology, slavery, warfare, labor, bioresearch, prosthetics and agriculture, all areas examined in relation to our subject of human-machine advancement.
Circuit breakers in.
We have separation.
Inboard and outboard, they're on. We're coming forward with the side stick.
Looks good.
Roger. I've got a blowout. Bay for three.
Get your pitch to zero.
Pitch is out. I can't hold altitude.
Correction. Alpha 4 is on.
Trip selected. Emergency.
Flight calm. I can't hold it. She's breaking up. She's breaking.
Steve Austin. Astronaut, a man barely alive.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Steve Austin will be that man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Life within a Confederate hospital was a harrowing experience for most patients. Thousands of soldiers suffered from a variety of disfiguring injuries, many of which made it difficult or impossible to lead an otherwise normal life. Their first introduction to hospital life began when they were carried from the field on stretchers and taken to small forward aid stations. There, assistant surgeons provided first aid to the wounded and routed cases onto field hospitals, which were temporary hospitals set up in tents or buildings behind the lines. The primary function of the field hospital was to receive wounded from the field, stabilize their condition, perform necessary amputations, and then evacuate them to general hospitals where they were treated and, if they didn't die, either discharged or returned to the Army. The majority of soldiers arriving at field hospitals had wounds to their extremities. When bone damage was severe, amputation was the prescribed method of preventing a life-threatening infection, gangrene, or death.
75% of the wounds that soldiers received were to their extremities, either to their arms or to their legs. And 76% of the wounds were caused by the mini ball, this conical-shaped bullet of soft lead. And what tended to happen is when the mini ball struck, if it struck bone, it didn't just fracture the bone as a musket ball might have done. It shattered the bone. It drove bone fragments into the surrounding area. And in addition to this, because this bullet is of soft lead, it would mushroom out. It would form a much larger hole. They did need a second assistant to stabilize the limb that was going to be amputated. So there would be an assistant to hold onto this leg, make sure that it was at the correct angle so that when the surgeon does the cutting, that saw doesn't get into a bind. There was a third assistant who would be in charge of the brass screw tourniquet. This is going to keep our patient from bleeding to death while he's on the operating table. A lot of people know that they didn't sterilize the instruments. Another problem that was equally as bad is that often the instruments were not as sharp as they were supposed to be. So instead of getting a nice clean incision, it was often more of a ripping and tearing that went on. But the Catlin knife was used simply to cut through the skin. And let's say that our patient was wounded here. We're going to move up slightly above that wound and make an incision in the skin. And then that skin would be peeled back. The surgeon would then take a scalpel and use the scalpel to cut through the next layer of flesh, the muscles and tendons. And that incision would be made slightly further up the leg. And again, the cut would be made all the way around, and then that flesh is going to be peeled back. Now we're ready for the capital bone saw. And that is what was used to sever that limb. And the assistant here, who was stabilizing this leg, take that leg, throw it into a pile with all the other arms and legs that had been cut off that day. After the leg has been severed, after that bone has been cut, the surgeon would take this device, a tenaculum, and use this to grab a hold of arteries and blood vessels. And they're elastic. They tend to retract and go back into the body. Tenaculum was used to hook those vessels, pull them out, and then the surgeon would ligate them or tie them off using either silk thread or horsehair. After the arteries were ligated, the surgeon would then make sure that the end of that bone was smooth. There may be some shards left behind. So the surgeon would take these gnawing forceps or bone nippers and just nip off any jagged pieces of bone. Then he might take a bone file and smooth off the end of that bone so that it's nice and smooth. When the surgeon cut, he cut skin, then he cut muscle, then he cut bone. So what you end up with is a flap of muscle and skin that hangs down beyond the bone, and that forms the stump. That will be a cushion against the end of that bone.
About 25,000 Confederate soldiers returned to their homes having suffered the amputation of a limb. Some of these veterans consider their missing limbs something of a badge of honor and proudly displayed their empty sleeves. Others felt less than whole and wanted to appear like their old selves. Private individuals and companies found plenty of business manufacturing artificial limbs. North Carolina's state government established a revolutionary program to provide prosthetic limbs for amputees, which other state governments later duplicated. Some of these limbs were very simple and inexpensive and were little more than wooden stumps, while others were more elaborate and realistic. Although these prostheses often cause pain or discomfort for veterans, they offered the opportunity for their wearers to lead a more normal life.
And they told me shortly after my accident that we're going to give you an operation here. We're going to be able to save all your nerve function.
At that time, artificial limbs were wooden replicas or hooks with limited functions, but his doctors knew that a bionic hand might be possible. Today, it is a reality, and Erminio Bugliani's long wait is over.
You know, it almost felt like it was a part of me, and that's the truth.
Erminio is getting fitted with a new prosthetic hand called the iLimb. Sensors embedded in the arm read electrical impulses from the brain to open or close the hand. Then a microprocessor in the palm of the hand controls the individual motors in each finger to determine the force needed to hold different objects.
There you go.
Prosthetist Jared Howell says Erminio's ability to operate the hand on his first day exceeds expectations.
To have him actually put the hand on and be able to manipulate objects, close and open the hand, you know, control the thumb, control the fingers, all of that in the very first day, to the extent that he was able to do it, I was impressed.
Touch Bionics, the Scottish company that makes the hand, says more than 400 amputees are now using the iLimb, which can cost between $50,000 and $70,000. It is a lot of money, but the dexterity it offers is unlike any previous prosthetic device.
Sounds real.
Upon seeing Erminio with a working hand, his sister, Lisa Murphy, cried.
He's not going to be looked at as the man without a hand. He'll actually be able to walk into a store and be just like a normal person.
See, now all of a sudden you've got a pointer finger.
But Erminio was less emotional.
I wouldn't say there's going to be any tears from this direction. If anything, there's going to be some hoots and hollering and joyous in that regard.
Can you hold my hand?
Instead of celebrating, Erminio Bugliani is too focused on his new hand and the possibilities that lie ahead.
So we're controlling this prosthesis on an instant-by-instant basis. So this is our robot arm. This is our training that we go through with our monkeys as they go through and try to learn how to use this robot. So they're using brain signals, so signals from their motor cortex that we pull out of wires into our system, and our computers then decode what it is that the monkey's intending to do and drive the endpoint of this arm forward and backward and around through space. The monkeys have brain control over this robotic arm to move it forward and grab a piece of fruit as it's presented and then bring it back to their mouth to feed themselves.
Incredible as it may seem, these monkeys learned to feed themselves with a robot arm that was being directly controlled by their brains, as if it was simply part of them.
This is a biofeedback closed-loop kind of experiment, and that there's almost an automatic learning that's going on, where we're communicating with the animal by displaying the behavior. So the robot arm moves, or a cursor moves in virtual reality. That's information to the animal as to how well it's doing. It only gets a reward if it does this task correctly. So it wants to optimize its ability to be successful. So there's this instantaneous analysis going on incrementally through the movement. Something like, am I moving the correct way? If not, how do I correct it? And then you make an attempt to correct it and you say, did I improve it or make it worse? And then so this trial and error thing, eventually there's some kind of combination of events that improves the behavior, and the animal is able to recognize that and use that repeatedly, and that's how learning takes place.
If a monkey could produce those signals without the need of moving, a human being in the future that cannot move could think about moving, and somehow this type of technology one day could help him or her enact the movements that she can no longer or he can no longer produce. That realization was instantaneous, you know, because you could see movement being generated by the brain, sending 300 milliseconds to a robotic device without any muscle contraction happening. And the goal of the behavior was being achieved.
Matthew James has always had to perform everything with his right hand because born without a left one, he's had no choice until now. Courtesy of a Formula One racing team, the bionic arm has transformed Matthew's ability to perform daily tasks.
There are two electrodes located at the front and the back of the hand, which send signals to a small computer chip, which I believe is located there, which then again sends more almost information down to these five motors located in the fingers and the thumb to make them move, or an equivalent to the grip patterns.
It was a letter that he wrote to Mercedes boss Ross Braun that persuaded them to share microtechnology with the firm building bionic limbs. Even offering to have Michael Schumacher's Mercedes logo on the hand, he never expected it to go anywhere.
I was just thinking, oh, I'll send a letter off. They might be nice. They might, like, maybe give me a T-shirt if they, like, feel like it. But I really didn't think it would develop onto something this big.
Although using the new hand is still proving difficult, soon Matthew hopes the things that others take for granted, he'll be able to take for granted as well.
For nearly a month, 27-year-old Pierpaolo Petruzziello was the bionic man science fiction writers have long envisioned. Using only his mind to control a biomechanical hand connected to his nervous system.
Ho avuto un incidente nel 2006.
I had a car accident in 2006 caused by a drunk driver. My car turned upside down and I lost my left hand and forearm. My father was devastated and began searching online for projects that could help me.
That pioneering project turned out to be at Rome's Campus Biomedico, a university and hospital developing a bionic hand in collaboration with the Santa Anna School in Pisa, Italy. After passing several tests, the Brazilian Petruzziello was enrolled in the Life Hand Project. Four miniature electrodes were surgically implanted in what remained of his left arm. These electrodes helped him recognize and control the biomechanical hand.
Basically, we sent him various stimuli. He had to learn how to localize them in his lost hand and fingers.
The prosthetic itself was not implanted, only connected through electrodes.
I needed a lot of electrical stimulation. Like the majority of amputees, I still perceive my lost hand. As they stimulated my arm with needles, I closed my eyes and tried to think that my hand did exist. You don't have your hand. You don't have your forearm, so how can you control the hand movements? It's difficult to explain. I closed my eyes and repeated to myself, your hand does exist. It's there, it's in place. At a mental level, it's very stressing. I needed to concentrate. I needed silence. Then I said to myself, you can wiggle the fingers, you can pinch, you can clench a fist, you can open your hand, you can just do that.
Though similar experiments have previously been performed, project researchers said this was the first time a patient has been able to make such complex movements in a biomechanical hand using only his mind. The $3 million project was funded by the European Union and took 5 years to complete.
When I succeeded in closing the hand, I felt like I scored a goal at the last minute. It was such an important moment. The researchers looked at me and I understood that we made it. I haven't done all this just for myself. I've lost a hand, but there are people who have lost more and are suffering. I felt like I was helping science, and for this reason, I never gave up. I'm happy now.
Their next challenge? Connecting a patient's nervous system and prosthetic limb for years. Not just a month. And Petruzziello is guaranteed one of those limbs.
We'll be right back.
This is Corporal Joshua Belial's fourth set of legs.
I can do about, you know, five times the distance with these legs that I could in a normal, just normal walking on flat level planes.
They are his power knees.
They each have a motor in them, and it actually drives forward when I walk. It actually powers that knee through the step.
The power knees are as high-tech as they come, powered through Bluetooth technology.
So each, you know, has a transmitter and receiver in each leg, and they talk to each other and try to mimic the stride length that the other one's doing. If I speed up, the other one can realize it's doing it, and it'll speed up as well.
They weren't originally designed for double amputees because the prosthetic was meant to take cues from a real leg. But it works well for Corporal Belial, who lost his legs when an IED hit his convoy in Fallujah, Iraq in 2006.
The IED went off directly underneath me and took off basically everything that was hanging over the ledge of the seat, my legs. And then it killed my sergeant in front of me and my good friend next to me. My gunner lost his right leg. I shattered my hip. I have 32 pins in my hip. I broke my pelvis, so I have a 6-inch screw holding that together. I lost both legs above the knee. I broke four fingers, broke my jaw, broke my nose, lacerated kidney. So I've recovered well, I think, and great care here and done well.
Today, he's one of less than a handful of Marines at Walter Reed Army Medical Center who have tested and used the Bluetooth prosthetics.
It's a lot of hip control. In my other legs, I usually have to use all my thigh to power through things, but since these are moving on their own, then I actually just kind of have to lift and shift my weight a little bit.
He says they're a bit heavier than the other two microchip prosthetics he's worn, but they require much less effort to operate.
Just standing and doing everyday things, you know, changing my shirt, you know, brushing my teeth, I can actually just stand there throwing the football back and forth. I can stand without, you know, holding on to anything. If they're not programmed right, they kind of do their own thing sometimes, and they'll kick for no reason. Like, you'll just be standing there and be like, and just kick off to the side.
But after 2 months, he's got his power legs in shape, although he's not been able to master the stairs just yet. They've improved his balance, but he uses two canes as a precaution.
Sometimes when you go near a computer or something, you'll hear the computer start frizzing, you know, so it does do that a lot, and I'll be like, I'm sorry, and I have to turn my legs off.
The only other time Corporal Belial turns his legs off, except when he's not using them, is at night when he charges them.
This is the latest weapon on the battlefield. It's not a robot, but a bionic leg attached to Sergeant Jordan Smith, U.S. Army.
It's kind of like I had my leg back when I got this one. We're going to start giving you power now. Wow, that's awesome.
Sergeant Smith and his bionic ankle have come to Tactical Defense Institute in Adams County, one of five amputees participating in a pilot program learning how to handle firearms using their bionic limbs.
Yeah, you're pretty decent. Good, good.
It was a bullet that took Sergeant Smith's leg, fired by an Iraqi insurgent during an ambush in Baghdad. The names of his buddies who didn't survive are etched into one of his three remaining limbs. He was the lucky one.
It's rough. It's hard. I kind of, why me? Why did I live and they didn't? Why did I get hurt? I mean, 4 inches. The bullet would have missed me. Either way, 4 inches.
The infantryman has been using the iWalk Biome foot for about a year.
My good leg gets tired before my prosthetic leg. This one's got assistance. I mean, it's I'm trying to keep up with it.
That's because it is truly bionic. A piston replaces the calf muscle and Achilles tendon, and with 6 microcomputers on board, it even does the thinking for the lower leg.
This seems to go beyond what the manufacturers are even claiming it'll do.
Sam Santarita owns SRT Prosthetics, which fits amputees with several kinds of artificial limbs.
Perfect. There you go. Now we just need a reload.
Like the bionic knee, but the Biome ankle is a game changer.
It's the first product I've seen in 25 years that actually mimics what the human body is doing, and in some ways is superior in strength to the power that's in the human ankle.
You heard right. It's stronger than the human leg it replaces. Strong enough to send this soldier back into combat. Sergeant Smith says it's as simple as reloading.
It's a battery. It doesn't get tired. It dies, swap them out. 2 seconds, you're going right back at it.
On my other legs, I walk a little bit slower. Now that I have this thing, I find my right leg trying to keep up with it.
Retired Marine Rob Warner lost his leg in a motorcycle crash between deployments. His unit went to Afghanistan without him, and many did not come home.
It felt horrible. Those are my brothers.
Warner chose retirement. But more and more military amputees are staying on active duty and returning to the battle. A generation ago, nearly 98% of amputee warriors would leave the military. Now the Army says 1 out of 5 single amputation soldiers returns to full duty.
Everything was left up to me. What do you want to do? That was the big question. What do you feel comfortable doing? Do you want to stay active duty? Do you want to retire? And I chose to stay in.
That's why the Defense Department and Veterans Administration funded development of the bionic ankle and other advanced prosthetics. Imagine the enemy seeing this entering the room. But now civilian amputees are also benefiting from this military technology.
Now you're stable.
We are probably going to see people that are performing at a higher level than able-bodied people.
Plant, drop, whack that guy, pivot. Plant, drop, then make your entry.
Tactical Defense Institute and SRT are now offering a firearms course just for amputees.
Carry that gun anywhere they need to carry it to, and then you're never going to get tied up in the steering wheel.
But Sergeant Smith can slip on his bionic leg and keep up with just about anyone.
I can do this.
In 2005, the Defense Department's Experimental Research Wing, DARPA, created a program to make the next generation of prosthetic arms for returning soldiers who had lost limbs in combat. One contract went to DECA Research, headed by Dean Kamen, inventor of the Segway. Inspired by the sophisticated prosthesis in Star Wars, Kamen set out to make what he calls his Luke arm.
I spent a couple of weeks traveling around the country visiting people that they recommended I talk to, so that I could get an assessment of what is the current state of the art before we agreed that we would try to go do this. If you looked at the relative capability of lower limb prosthetics versus upper limb, it's, you know, upper limbs are the Flintstones and the lower limbs are in the 21st century.
Chuck Hildreth is one of several DECA test pilots. Amputees who help Kamen's engineers optimize the Luke arm before it goes to official clinical trials. Kamen's team decided that the arm needed 4 main characteristics. It had to be modular, lightweight, agile, and it had to support customizable controls.
The arm that we've made is modular, so we can actually take pieces of the arm to fit all 3 levels of those amputations.
DECA engineers built the arm in independent sections so it could be customized for any amputee. From the hand, they can add a forearm, an elbow, and even a shoulder socket.
Better when you plug it in. Yeah.
Hildreth lost both of his arms when he was electrocuted 26 years ago. Today, he's testing a Luke arm on his left side, where he still has a short residuum.
What does it feel like wearing that?
It's kind of liberating. I mean, I've been without an arm for 26 years.
Weight is another big challenge in making a prosthetic practical.
You have to make an arm that, you know, is atomically correct.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to make it, you know, weigh as little as possible.
Engineers modeled the Luke arm on an average female arm.
Right.
This particular arm actually weighs less than 8 pounds. That's including all the electronics and the battery.
The Luke arm also had to be agile enough to do exactly what the human arm can do.
So far, the test pilots, within a matter of you know, 5 to 10 hours of practice can operate, you know, operate the arm such that they can, you know, pick up small objects or stack cups. They can, you know, eat grapes.
The arm is able to handle these complex tasks because of the complexity of the electronics inside.
The technology, like lithium batteries, got within reach. In the last few years, processing became ubiquitous, and the size and power consumption of processors got within reach of doing this.
There's actually, like, 12 microprocessors in the arm.
These sophisticated electronics also allow sensory feedback.
We have a small sensor in the thumb. It sends a signal to one of the microprocessors, which then goes to a small vibrating motor.
Oh, wow.
The harder they grip, the higher the frequency the vibration becomes. So it gives them direct feedback. It's going to use their gripping. Lots of practice.
Good grip strength.
It does have a good grip strength.
The electronics support a variety of inputs. Mm-hmm. Depending on the user, the arm can be controlled by nerves, muscles, or even foot pedals.
Oh, how cool.
And if I push on my little toe, it goes down. And then I have a myocyte up here, I switch.
Oh, modes. Yeah, with your muscles.
So now, when I push on the ball of my foot, it rotates the wrist. Push on the outside, it rotates.
The next step could be a take-home clinical trial where users like Chuck subject the arm to their everyday routines.
Certainly, we hope within the next, if we can follow a program in the next years, we can actually have a commercially available arm.
I've been able to do stuff with this that I haven't done in 26 years.
Like what?
Pick up a banana, peel a banana and eat it without it squishing it.
And the payback we get is when somebody like Chuck says, I fed myself for the first time in 26 years. That's why we build medical products.
I can't wait to get one of these in a real environment, home environment.
Yeah.
Actually, my wife can't either.
Yeah.
She's going, oh yeah, I got lots of stuff for you to do.
After a shooting accident when he was 9, Rob had to have his eyes surgically removed. But after joking with friends about having a robotic cyborg one installed instead, documentary maker Rob actually went and did it.
Pretty much anyone who loses an eye will make a joke, at least, I should get a camera put in there. It's not a wacky, out-of-this-world concept.
Years of hard work and research have left him with this, a tiny camera implanted in his eye socket, which transmits video wirelessly to screens, TVs, hard drives and cameras. And it's opened up a whole new perspective for him, even getting him offers of, unsurprisingly, secret camera work.
One very high-up news executive said, would I like to go to Iraq with my prosthetic eye and see what I could see there? Because sometimes when you have a giant camera, it's not such a great idea in a war zone.
I recently traveled around.
But instead, sci-fi fan Rob went around the world making a documentary on cyborgs alongside the makers of the computer game Deus Ex. That game features a cyborg from the future. Here's one from today.
American soldiers are well trained and physically fit, but they're still vulnerable. The human machine gets tired, needs rest, and performs only within the limitations of flesh and bones. But Rex Jameson here is stepping inside a robotic exoskeleton that mirrors or mimics everything he wants to do. 200-pound pull-downs, no sweat.
We did this 500 times until we got bored, so I could basically do it, you know, ad nauseum.
And you're talking, you're not even out of breath now.
No.
Not out of breath, not weary, no muscle pains or strains. If Rex needs to pull away from the exoskeleton to do something on his own, it just floats and waits for his return.
I can, you know, go ahead and do whatever I need to do. And
when you're ready to.
And then when I'm ready, just grab it and away we go.
It's taken Utah-based Sarcos 6 years to get to this point, but the technicians and engineers here who've pulled this off have been designing and polishing robots for decades. Each one of these ammo cans weighs 72 pounds. Imagine trying to lift 150 to 200 of these onto this pallet. Commanding his exoskeleton, Rex does it. In this round, Robin lifting 35-pound canisters. Several of us moving as fast as we can't keep up. Look at Steve Emero's forehead. How worn out are you by now?
I don't feel like I could keep going, but I bet Rex can.
Lifting 200-pound weights, piece of cake. Walking upstairs, no problem. Running, walking on your heels, prancing and dancing, taking on a ramp, the list goes on. Meshed with exoskeleton, Rex punches this bag with just the right amount of strength. From enough grace to gently play ball, to enough superpower to load a missile on an airplane. Exoskeleton does it all.
He uses get out of way of control, which follows from his end effectors, the feet and the hands, and the machine will just follow where he goes.
During these experiments, the prototype is tethered. There's also a safety line as a precaution, but the end product will be 100% portable with its own backpack power. And the skeletons in various models will be covered, offering different levels of protection for the soldier inside. Circuitry boards for every part of the body. Flexible robotic joints that mimic every movement. Eventually, exoskeletons could even become autonomous, allowing the soldier to step out, then to go on and perform a task on its own.
If you step out of it, it becomes a humanoid robot. If you step into it, it becomes a teleoperated robot. It becomes a superhero, superhuman strength.
Survival rates for combat wounded are higher than ever before, and that means many more service members are coming home with severe injuries, such as the loss of a limb. For those who suffer an upper extremity loss, there's new hope on the horizon. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, is funding a long-term effort to build a state-of-the-art prosthetic arm. Marine Sergeant Ashley Bryant tells us the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago is driving the medical end. And the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab is working to put better prosthetics within wounded warriors' reach.
It feels more real than I ever expected it to. It was actually surprising the first time I put this arm on. I was kind of creeped out at how it would hold on to things.
Claudia Mitchell lost her real arm in a motorcycle accident. The former Marine is helping a team of doctors, engineers, researchers, and scientists reach into the future. This is affectionately referred to as Prototype 1, and it works using targeted muscle reinnervation, which combines a surgical procedure with state-of-the-art sensors and electronics. Dr. Todd Quicken pioneered the surgery.
And the idea is that we take the leftover nerves that used to go to the arm and transfer them to different muscles and skin. So, for example, with a shoulder disarticulation patient, we've taken the four main nerves that go down the arm and transferred them onto different chest and side muscles.
But are you making that work just by
thinking?
That's it.
This is the best arm to date that they have, but this is going to be the best arm.
Jesse Sullivan used to work as a lineman for a Tennessee power company.
And I got into 7,200 volts, and it burnt both my arms, and breaker operated, so I took it twice. Went up one arm, out the other one. Should have gone to the cemetery, should have buried me. I always like to thank divine intervention that God knew that Dr. Kiken needed a guinea pig.
Jesse was the first to undergo the innervation surgery. Watch this video of Jesse's muscle movements. The black marks are where electrodes are placed, which measure muscle signals. Those signals are then passed to the mechanical arm. It's tricky because the prosthetic must fit, despite all that movement, very closely, so the electrodes stay in constant contact with the skin.
I'm doing just like you do. To raise the elbow, I just lift my elbow, my phantom. Just by doing my phantom limb, turn the palm up.
New developments need to be tested, so Jesse and Claudia are often asked to come to the lab.
So we have a few minutes of learning curve every time we interact with each other. Okay, Jesse, I'm ready to arm wrestle. All right. I'm going to take you.
This session marks the beginning of phase two of the project. The goal is to get more natural control of the arm and, essentially, to get the nerve remapping to work in reverse. It's called targeted sensory reinnervation.
Sensory feedback is very, very important, not only so we can detect touch and temperature and contact and vibration and so forth, but also just force, the force of gripping something. You want to crush your styrofoam cup, for example.
Well, when we transfer those nerves, we can also cut the nerve to overlying skin so it goes numb, and then the hand nerves will grow into it so that when you touch this chest skin, the patient feels like they're touching their hand. Claudia, what do you feel right there?
Index finger.
And how about over here?
Pinky.
And up there?
Thumb.
And that's kind of a hard one to get your head around, but it's a portal into the sensory system for us. That was a little lower than that. Anyhow, there's a spot where if you touch it, Claudia feels her finger moving back. So imagine having a sensor in the prosthetic hand that when you pick up a cup, it tells you when you've touched the cup and then how hard you're squeezing. And we take that signal and bring it up to something that pushes on this skin.
The first time I noticed that I was in the shower and I felt warm water and I could feel the heat in my hand. And so I hurried up and I finished my shower and I called Dr. Peck and I was like, it's working, I feel my hand.
I don't like it. I wish I had my arms back, you know. But being I have to wear prosthetics and given the opportunity to be a part of a project that's going to improve prosthetics from here on out for the future, is what an honor it is. But someday I'd like for this to be hanging in the Smithsonian and somebody walk by and say, God, wouldn't you hate it to wear that? You know, look how far they've come. So the future is, to me, is... this is the beginning of the future.
Even though the first seen and most famous Terminator, the T-101 model, first graced the screen in 1984, the original Terminator was in fact built in the early 21st century. The T-1 models were first seen in the third film of the franchise. They were battle robots used by the U.S. military that became self-aware when Skynet is switched on. While less advanced than the T-101 model, this model is still extremely dangerous as it is the ancestor to all future future Terminator models. The next Terminator model seen in the film series is the T-101, also known as the T-800. The franchise, however, has introduced several other models to explain the gap between the well-known Terminator and its earliest ancestor. The T-600 model appears in the TV series Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles. Despite some models of the T-600 being covered in a skin of rubber, they were much easier to spot than the newer T-800 model, which was, in fact, covered with living human tissue, making it look identical to other humans. The tissue that surrounds the cyborg allows it to even sweat and bleed. However, it still does not feel pain, as the flesh is simply a cover for the Terminator's powerful endoskeleton, run by a series of hydraulic servo mechanisms. This endoskeleton gives the model superhuman strength and has also proven nearly indestructible to 20th century weapons. The T-800 is so advanced, its central processing unit even gives it the ability to learn after it has been in contact with humans.
I know now why you cry.
As impressive as the T-800 model seems, it is relatively outdated compared to the T-1000 featured in Terminator 2. This time sent back to eliminate the threat of John Connor and the Resistance, the T-1000, still with all the features of its predecessor, was built with a mimetic polyalloy, which allowed it to emulate anything it touched perfectly. This polyalloy also gives the T-1000 the ability to reform itself in seconds, even after substantial damage. Along with these significant upgrades, the T-1000 has an improved repertoire of human emotion, which allows it to blend in even better with humans. A composite between the T-800 and the T-1000, the T-X was actually a solid endoskeleton coated with the mimetic polyalloy. Because of previous models' inability to travel back in time with weapons, the T-X was actually built with internal weapons, making it much more dangerous than the previous models that could only fight hand-to-hand and with 20th century weapons. This new model is even capable of controlling other machines, including other Terminators, as it does in Terminator 3. Despite these being the main Terminator models featured throughout the first three films of the series, other models have been introduced in novels as well as in the television series.
Come with me if you want to live.
This shows just how much potential these fictional cyborgs have for plot lines. In Terminator Salvation, director Mick G even goes back to tell the story of how the T-800 was first created.
They are replicating human tissue for the T-800. If we let those things go online, then this war is over.
You may think you have little in common with this robot, but it is controlled by living brain cells much like those inside your own head. Researchers grew a collection of around 300,000 rat brain cells in the lab. The cells quickly grow connections to each other and start communicating using electrical pulses. When the clump of cells was connected to electrodes, some parts of it were found to respond predictably to signals from the robot's ultrasound distance sensor. The output from these cells can be used to control the robot's motor circuits, preventing it from bumping into obstacles. Because the brain cannot leave the lab, it communicates with the robot wirelessly. The team plan to use their robot's brain power for new patterns of behavior in future. They hope there are enough similarities to teach us about unknown aspects of our own brain activity.
You have been listening to the program Human Machine on WGXC. Listen to subsequent episodes, where we continue our conversation on the nature of being in an age of human-machine evolution.
I can do this.